Well, good morning, everyone. Here in the Loon Lake Zendo, with the basketball hoop and the lines on the floor, and out there in the Zoomiverse, wherever you all are. It makes me really happy that you're all showing up for Sesshin. I hope the people on Zoom have been able to make contact, given possible power outages. We are on Loon Lake's trusty generator at present here, unlike the old days when we had to put on our headlamps to read the chant books. Anybody remember that? Yes, some of you do. But this may be the most rain that has fallen in this amount of time at Loon Lake. Rain is not unprecedented, but this much. The camp manager, Karim, just told me that it was absolute chaos this morning on the roads. Roads are closed. There was a landslide on Lougheed Highway. It's just, so this is a really good place to be right now. We have power. We don't have to go anywhere. We can be really grateful to be here this morning. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can realize the Buddha Dharma. Did you know that before Michael said that yesterday? Only a monk in the whole world can sit Sesshin. So Michael gave you an introduction to our Sesshin theme, only a Buddha and a Buddha. And I thought we could call it co-awakening or co-enlightenment or co-enlightening. Deliberately, I want to use enlightening, co-enlightening, rather than enlightenment. Because enlightenment is a tricky word. It seems to imply some sort of state, some sort of steady state or goal. You know, like score, through the goalpost, made it to enlightenment. And our culture is so strongly goal-oriented, as you well know. You know, we want to be winners. We don't want to feel like losers in the race to enlightenment, do we? And, you know, we tend to dismiss the value of, we tend to dismiss the value of process, of dynamic process, which is the nature of the universe, so it might be a good idea for us to get used to it. It's the nature of time, of space, of relationship, dynamic process. And this is also the nature of Dogen's radical unity of practice, realization, and actualization. We could also use the words practice, awakening, and living it. Dogen says that's all one dynamic process. It's not linear. And when we really deeply realize this, when we realize this is our nature, we're able to give and receive in our relationships with others without that constant calculation and comparison, you know, that we are conditioned to do. Are we getting as much as we're giving? Shouldn't they be giving us a little bit more? And without pursuing our own opinions and agendas so strongly, when we really get this, we can enter into friendships as deep explorations, opportunities to see through another set of eyes than our own, widening and deepening our view of the world. Some of you know the story of, and Michael told it not long ago, I can't remember exactly when, Michael told the story of the Buddha's faithful attendant, Ananda, once exclaiming to the Buddha, "Noble friendship is half the holy life." He was all excited about this. And the Buddha said, "Oh, no, Ananda, don't say that. Noble friendship is the whole of the holy life." That's how it's translated, but yeah. And that noble friendship is a translation of the Pali words Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta, noble friend, Kalyanamittata, noble friendship. And it's a really important part of our practice. It's through relationship that we develop and practice the Eightfold Path. How can you practice right speech, conduct, and livelihood in a cave all by yourself? You know, we all, you know, how many of you have wished to be a hermit, you know, and maybe not a cave, but a little cabin somewhere, right? You know, sure, me too. But even the hermits in the cave, even those hermits, those classic hermits, we talked about them, I don't know, which sesshin was that? In the course of the pandemic, we did one series on the hermits.
Summer 2020.
Thank you. And we realized that they weren't isolated, they weren't out of relationship, they were very close relationship to the natural world, always, those old hermits. But they'd go visit each other. And there are poems in the literature of, oh, you know, the hermit from the next mountain came to visit me and we had tea, right? So there's no way we can do this without being in relationship. That's what gives us, activates the Eightfold Path. So through this session, we thought we would give you some examples of Kalyanamitta, noble friendship, some from the tradition, from the Buddhist and Zen traditions, and some much closer to our own times that kind of show us examples of co-awakening. Throughout the koan literature, there are many tales of long-standing Zen friendships, right? Most often monks, Dharma brothers, because I think some of the women's stories didn't make it into the literature. Often an older and a younger monk accompanying each other on pilgrimages through the mountains, working in the temple gardens, keeping each other alert in a kind of call and response. Duet. My favorites are Dongshan and Chenshan, whose names are the two syllables from their names create the two syllables of our practice lineage, Soto Zen. And it would be Shendong in the Chinese. Those are our two founders. My favorite story among the Dongshan, Shenshan stories, is one that some of you would have heard me tell before. And they were Dharma brothers, although Dongshan was senior. And they lived in 9th century China. And they often went on pilgrimage through the mountains. And one time they came to a raging river. Maybe it had been raining for 3 days straight. Right? How many of you have hiked in the mountains? You know, West Coast mountains particularly, and those streams can really get raging and a little scary to cross if you have to ford the creek or there's a slippery log going across. So, you know, it's kind of, maybe they're really, you know, icy cold if they're a glacier-fed stream full of slippery, mossy rocks. So it's a little scary. So Dongshan said to his friend Shenshan, "Don't make a mistake or you'll fall into the river." And Shenshan replied, "If I make a mistake, I won't live to cross the river." And then Dongshan says, "What is the state of no mistakes?" Maybe he caught his friend's eye. You know, what is the state of no mistakes? And Shenshen said, "Crossing the river with you, elder brother." I really, that's my favorite. And I've given other talks that included it because mistakes are such an issue in our practice, right? You come to Sesshin and you go, oh, am I going to hit that bell right? Or am I going to bow in the wrong place? You know, it can create a certain, am I going to drop my chopsticks on the floor? It's so embarrassing to make mistakes. So that's such an important part of our practice. We get to watch our mind react to mistakes in Sesshin, watch our conditioned mind. And then we just get to regroup and do the next thing and let go. And be kind to ourselves and others when we see them make mistakes. Or notice our judging mind. Oh, look at the way that person's walking. So it's really a good part of our practice. But if we can learn from Dongshan and Shenshan, I think, to find the place of no mistakes. But really, much as I love those old stories, today I want to talk about a much more contemporary example. I want to talk about the decades-long friendship between two American poets, Wendell Berry and Gary Snyder. Many of you know their work. They happen to be the two first poets I ever fell in love with, still in my teens. Because their relationship to what we call the natural world, the more than human world, resonated so strongly with my own experience. Sadly, I didn't know of any women poets in my teens. Seems like another era, I guess it was, not to have known of any women poets when I was young. I think somewhere inside I wished to be a woman Wendell Berry, Gary Snyder. And yet I felt profoundly not entitled to a place or a voice in their world. And I sensed that what I would say and how I'd say it might be a little different. I think the women Wendell Berry, Gary Snyders are still finding their places and voices in our world. I'm not sure if I can articulate if or how that they are different, those voices, or even my own. I think I'm probably proposing a PhD thesis that someone may have already have written. So I'll get back to the rich and wonderful friendship that these two poets developed over many years. Only a poet and a poet, awakening each other. In their exploration of the cultivated and the wild, Christian and Buddhist thought, activism, ecology, ethics, and of course, poetry and prose. So I'm going to draw on this book of their letters. It's called Distant Neighbors, which is exactly what they were. And these letters reveal a shared spirit of hospitality, generosity, curiosity, and caring. Both men are strong-minded and open-hearted. And it's a delight to see how they negotiated their differences of opinion. I think they are a model for our contemporary world where public discourse has so deteriorated into rapid-fire, knee-jerk, hostile reactivity, and where rigid stance-taking and mutual vilification has replaced a kind of measured negotiation and consideration of different points of view. I don't want to take for granted that you all know these poets, so I want to introduce them first by their poems and then give you just a little background about each one. The first poem I ever encountered by Wendell Berry, the first poem probably that I ever really loved, it's an old one, it's called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So that poem, I think, sustained me through my high school years because I felt understood. I don't remember the first Gary Snyder poem I loved. There are several that I first copied out. But it might well have been this one. For the children, the rising hills, the slopes of statistics lie before us, the steep climb of everything going up, up as we all go down. In the next century, or the one beyond that, they say, our valleys, pastures, we can meet there in peace if we make it. To climb these coming crests, one word to you and your children. Stay together, learn the flowers, go light. So Gary Snyder is the older of the two. He was born in 1930. Which means he turned 91 this year. He's born in San Francisco in a leftist working class family and spent much of his childhood in Oregon, where his parents had a small mixed farm and a cedar shingle operation. When he was 7, he was bedbound for 4 months from some kind of accident. And that began his lifelong love of books and reading, because his mother supplied him with a continuous supply of library books. The coastal mountain environment of his teen years nourished his love of mountain climbing and his interest in Coast Salish indigenous culture. In his early years, in his 20s, he worked as a merchant seaman, a logger, a fire lookout, and all those experiences worked their way into his poetry. He got a degree in anthropology and literature, but left graduate studies after one term. The call of poetry and the San Francisco beat scene was too strong. There he met Philip Whalen, poet and later Zen priest, and he studied Asian languages and cultures at University of California, Berkeley. That's where he began to publish and read his poetry in public along with luminaries such as Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. But he also really wanted to practice Zen seriously, so he found a way to go to Japan and practice at a Rinzai Zen temple in Kyoto in 1955. That's before everybody wanted to do it. And over the next 15 years, he went back and forth to Japan, practicing Zen, traveling, living in a commune on a small volcanic island, and then eventually returning to settle on land with his family, his Japanese wife and two sons, on land in the Sierra foothills in California. He wanted to put down roots and live close to the land in community. And this is where the friendship between Barry and Snyder begins. In 1973, once Snyder has settled, Barry is 4 years younger, having grown up in Kentucky, in a politically active farming family. He got a degree in English, published his first novel in 1960, and then in 65, he and his wife, with their two children, bought a homestead along the Kentucky River and began to farm it. So by the 1970s, both men were writing poetry and also essays, and Barry was also writing novels. And they were deeply engaged in issues such as agriculture, land use, forestry, and wilderness, as well as peace and environmental activism. So the two were introduced by an editor and publisher who knew them both well and thought they might be a good match. So from across the continent, based in two very different environments, In days before internet and email, the two began a correspondence that would last for decades. In this book, the book spans 40 years of their correspondence up until, I think it goes to about 2009, a few years after the death of Snyder's wife, Carol Coda. So we can be confident that even now, into their later years, they're still in touch. From very early in the friendship, the two exchanged poems and essays, and they gave each other detailed, valued feedback, both praise and constructive criticism. And they engage with also philosophical and spiritual questions. They also reported on the weather, observation of nature, the challenges of gardening and farming, and the vicissitudes of family life. They tried, sometimes successfully, often not, to arrange visits to each other's places. And they always loved visiting each other. Often at time, the visits were timed to coordinate with readings and conferences they were attending. And they were always complaining about how busy they were, even before email. So I'm going to share some excerpts with you. This is Wendell Berry expressing his gratitude for Snyder's work. He says, "I hurry to say that I'm grateful to you for much more than your generosity to my writing. Your words, everywhere I find them, give me the sense of being spoken not just to, but for. What a relief. This is happening, I think, because our lives have forced us out of the career of poetry. To use the terms of your interview, after you give up poetry, then poems become ways of speaking to and for other people, not acquisitions like money to get something with. In what you say, I don't hear you speaking as a poet, but as a friend and fellow worker. And so you speak for me and relieve me of the confining, isolated necessity to speak for myself," he puts in quotes. Isn't that great? And then I want to read you a little bit of this extended discussion over a period of time over the question of how to live a life of non-harming. You know, the three pure precepts, do not harm, do good, benefit all beings. This is, so they didn't, they struggled with the concept of harm, of evil. So this is, again, this is Berry saying, "Living at peace is a difficult, deceptive concept. Same for not resisting evil. You can struggle and battle yourself, resist evil until you become evil, as anti-communism has become totalitarian." This is 1978, by the way. "But I don't feel the least bit of an inclination to lie down and be a rug either. And I now begin to ask myself if I can live at peace only by being reconciled to battle. Stonewall Jackson, a kind of ferocious saint. Oh my goodness, my American history is failing me. Stonewall Jackson, Civil War, I don't think so. That doesn't sound right. John, help me." Anyway, he was a feisty guy. Says Stonewall Jackson, a kind of ferocious saint, said he felt as safe as battle is in bed. And then, Barry asks, "Is that Satori?" So here's Snyder. "I still owe you a response to a letter earlier this spring on the question of bad land use, the nature of evil, and how one fights evil. I don't have a clear-cut answer to all that, but I would say that I try to reserve the term evil for the very highest quality of bad, not for just plain-out stupidity. Most of the negative things that happen in the world are a function of ignorance, stupidity, narrow views, simple-minded egotism. Evil is probably a byproduct of intelligent, complicated-minded egotism. In other words, not stupidity. What I think you are dealing with near your own place is not high-quality, genuine evil, but the lower-quality stuff. In which case, I would say use any honorable tactics that come your way in opposing and fighting such things with no fear of becoming stained by evil, because that's not really what you're up against. And of course, true warriors have a code: never to draw a sword until all other possible avenues of resolution of conflict have been explored, and upon using a sword, to use it with full effectiveness, but no more. At least that's the Japanese teaching. As for whether there really is or is not a substantial metaphysical evil in the universe, my own hunch and received teachings have been that even the scariest and worst-looking perversions or possibilities, satanic or Luciferian, are ultimately enclosed within the totality of the organic process and can be both understood and overcome. Barry responds, "Thank you for your note about evil. I see it, I think, pretty much your way. If you don't see how much badness comes from stupidity, ignorance, confusion, etc., if you don't see how much badness is done by good, likable people, if you don't love or don't know you love people whose actions you deplore, then I guess you go too far into outrage, acquire diseased motives, quit having any fun, and get bad yourself." So that's the two of them talking about evil, huh? Barry, in one of his letters, observed that the two of them share an interest. Here's how he put it: the intersection between enlightenment and householding. We are householders. You know, we're not 100% all the time monastics, right? And what he says to Snyder is, it forces us onto rougher ground than the smooth purists, but it gives us traction. So maybe that's a little like us, you know? We're going to go back out in the world after Sesshin, and it's going to feel a little rough, but it gives us traction, right? It helps us wake up. I appreciated reading these two poets complain to each other as they grew older, more famous, and busier with their schedules of readings and teachings and conferences, trying to find time for their writing and keeping up with their work on their homesteads. I could relate. Here is Snyder saying, "Here it is, day of the solstice and full moon too, a full quarter since you wrote me. I got back from the East Coast and the Midwest well worn out and went right to work on a foreword I'd promised for somebody else's book, right? I'm about to quit promising any more of those. And then got the firewood in before the rains came. Somehow took 6 weeks to do those two things. I'm about to radically change my life, finally, by cutting down on excess projects and efforts and promises. I begin to see it as a kind of very culpable spiritual pride that I keep thinking I can do so much. The effort becomes graceless after a while." This is Gary Snyder, right? And Wendell Berry says, "So the concerns spread out. It is clear that life does not get simpler. I learn it over and over, always with the same reluctance and regret. The notion that life could somehow be simplified has been powerful with me. I still yearn for it. If you were here, I'd get you to give me the Buddhist way of dealing with this problem." Okay, so here's what Gary says. "What's this about a simplified life? I tell people who are interested in that that they should be single and get a rented furnished room somewhere south of Market Street in San Francisco above a 24-hour cafeteria. I guess the answer to complexity, seriously, is organization and the acceptance of the necessity of maintenance. I always like the quote, energy flowing through a system tends to organize that system. So isn't that great? Instead of giving some, you know, Buddhist elevated wisdom, that's what he says. That's what he says. Oh, you know what? I skipped one. I'm going to back up. It's rainy out. It's good for just reading. Some of the lovely just passages describing their lives, you know, their where they live. This is Snyder. I'm sitting outside here by the fire, by the pond, listening to the sharp little slashing sound that bats make when they swoop down and hit the surface of the water after insects, along with the bullfrog booming, the crickets in the background, and the soft rustling of the fire. Enough music for anybody. Makes me think of the night at your place when the lightning was flashing all night and the firebugs were ecstatically responding to that, apparently thinking that the absolute principle in the sky was a firebug like themselves. Yeah. I'm not sure if I've been able to do justice to the generosity of their caring and thoughtful exchanges, not only across the geographical distance, but their different perspectives on religious and spiritual practice. Barry was deeply rooted in Christian biblical sources, although he called himself a forest Christian. And Snyder, of course, in Buddhist teachings and practice. But together they sort of parsed out the distinctions without any source of any sense of mutual threat or defensiveness. And they also found common ground. They found both common ground and intriguing differences between Barry's Eastern sort of pastoral agrarian way of husbanding the land and Snyder's intimacy with the wild. You know, living on the edge of the Sierras with wild things closer by. But maybe you get some sense of the kind of this kindness and generosity between these two men that accompanied a real intellectual rigor as well. And you can see how they awakened each other by sharing the minutiae of their daily lives on the land, the floods and fires. Barry would talk about the floods and Snyder would talk about the fires. And the seed time and harvest, you know, they would talk about. I don't think that. No, I'm going to back up. Yeah, here is Barry talking about their differences, their co-awakening. He says, because we have a good deal in common, our differences are instructive and clarifying and useful to me. Sometimes my awareness of where you are standing gives me a sort of binocular vision. Because, for instance, my point of view is pretty much that of a Christian, a forest Christian, it seems likely that you will want or need to disagree to some extent with my book. But if by dedicating the book to you, I made you feel that you should not disagree, I would look on that as a deprivation. I am very much in earnest in wanting to know exactly how you feel about this and am not at all in dread of any possible answer you may give me. Isn't that great? Yeah. here's Snyder offering a little Buddhist perspective. Again, this sort of they're talking about what we call the absolute and the relative. Is God, yeah, like Barry uses the language of God and Snyder doesn't, so how do we deal with that? And Snyder says, Buddhism handles the same rough dichotomy in a handy way by saying that they are different aspects of the same reality, from one side seen as historical and in time, in the realm of cause and effect, a realm in which we can improve things or ruin them, and do our training, practice, moral effort, work on our character, gradually become enlightened. The other side, the eternal moment, is inherent, self-created, imminent, and perfect, always there, so that when a person has finally perfected himself, they say, he might say, oh, I was here all the time and didn't know it. So, that's that impossible paradox of the relative and absolute, which are always simultaneously, always in our lives as they are. As I read these letters, I thought, I wondered if today's electronic media could create the same kind of kinship over time and distance. Our media that we use now don't lend themselves so well to these kind of deeply considered thoughts and words, to careful checking for misunderstanding, because they would check back and forth. Oh, did you mean that? Oh, no, I meant that. You know, they're very careful. So often, people don't even get to the end of an email or miss the attachment, right? Happens all the time. It's happened to every one of us, probably. And writing Zen emails is particularly frustrating because every time I use the word attachment or non-attachment, the program pops up a little box telling me, have I forgotten to add the attachment? And then I have to say, no, I haven't. It's not, I'm talking about a different kind of attachment. I did have to chuckle when, after Barry had published, and this would have been around 1987, he published an essay called Why I'll Never Buy a Computer. I'm sure he must have by now. And Snyder wrote him in 1988 saying, now I'll stretch your tolerance with this playful poem. And he enclosed a copy of his poem, Why I Take Good Care of My Macintosh. Do you want to hear a little? Okay. Because its keys click like hail on a rock, and it winks when it goes out, and puts word heaps in hordes for me, dozens of pockets of gold under boulders in stream beds, identical seed pods strong on a vine, or it stores bins of bolts, and I lose them and find them, because whole worlds of writing can be boldly laid out and then highlighted and vanish in a flash at delete. So it teaches of impermanence and pain. Because my wife likes it, and because my computer and me are both brief in this world, both foolish, and we have earthly fates. Because I have let it move in with me, right inside the tent, and it goes with me out every morning. We fill up our baskets, get back home, feel rich, relax. I throw it a scrap, and it hums. Elsewhere, Barry comments, I think it would be both surprising and disappointing if we agreed more than we do. If we agreed about everything, what would we have to say to each other? How would a how could a Buddha and a Buddha awaken if they agreed about everything? Michael's going to tell you a Zen story about this tomorrow. I wondered, as I thought about all this, what would happen if two oppositional people, maybe not hardcore, but, you know, oppositional, made a commitment to write each other a letter once a month for a year. Just telling each other about their lives, their family, their hopes and fears, their regrets and satisfactions, the weather, the signs of the seasons turning. How would they come to see each other after a year? We could try it. We could choose somebody. It could be a friend or somebody we don't know that well, and say, maybe your worst enemy might be, might not want to write letters for a year, but try, how would it be, you know, once a month to write a letter to somebody? Who writes letters anymore? Good, I'm glad. And then the thing with letters is you can put things in. You can put little seeds and dried flowers. My mom was famous for newspaper clippings. Who has paper newspapers anymore? Newspaper clippings with little notes in the margins. So you'd get this big fat letter with all these clippings, and the notes in the margins were part of the letter, right? You can put paper hearts and snowflakes in. You can put origami in. That's the good thing about letters, is what else you can put in. Haiku, put little haiku cards in. These are the gifts of letters from Kalyanamita. These are kind of the kind of letters that Kalyanamita send each other. So now I'm going to read you two poems that Gary Snyder and Wendell Berry wrote for each other. This is from Berry. To Gary Snyder. After we saw the wild ducks and walked away, drawing out the quiet that had held us. Oh, I should say this is about him and we as Berry and his son. Okay. After we saw the wild ducks and walked away, drawing out the quiet that had held us in wonder of them and of ourselves, Den said, I wish Mr. Snyder had been here. And I said, yes, but many fine things will happen here that you will not see. And I am resigned to ignorance of many that will happen in your hills. It cannot often be as it was when we heard geese in the air and ran out of the house to see them, wavering in long lines, high, southward, out of sight. By division we speak out of wonder. And this is Snyder's, and it's called Berry Territory. Many soft leaf structures, bush or tree, all angiosperms, blossoms pinched by frost. Under dead leaves, Tanya finds a tortoise, Tanya's Berry's wife. Under dead leaves, Tanya finds a tortoise, matching leaves, legs pulled in. And woodchuck holes that dive in under limestone ledges, sea bottom strata, brush their furry backs on shell and coral. Most holes with dry leaves scattered at the door, nobody there. A beach, silvery, smooth, FJ45, deeply carved. A chestnut oak, tall in the woods on heights above Kentucky River, this one born back in dreamtime. It has a shining being in it with eternal life. Wendell crouched down, sticks his face in a woodchuck hole. Hey, smell that. It's a fox. I go down on my knees, putting the opening to my face like a mask. No light, all smell, sour, warm, splintered bones, scats, feathers, wreathing bodies, wild, some home. So So I like to think of these two old friends as a modern-day Dongshan and Shanshan on pilgrimage together, meeting when they can, parting, flying back and forth, meeting again, sending letters, encountering obstacles along the way, encouraging each other, arguing good-humoredly about which turn to take. I like to think maybe they found the place of no mistakes, as we can here at Sesshin. This is our opportunity. In the midst of the roaring torrent out there, to find the place of no mistakes in good company. And so let's co-awaken as we go through Sesshin. Thank you, good friends.